Bobby Rivers, alone in a world that doesn't want him. We can rebuild him, make him better than he was before. Better, stronger, blacker. Mocha.
Bobby Rivers here with Mocha, man of a certain hue and age. I am so glad you're listening to this podcast. We love hearing from you. I heard from a couple of people and cannot thank you enough for listening. And I would not do this ever without the fabulous Keith Price, my friend, my producer. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you doing, Mr. Man?
Oh, you know, when I hear your voice, everything's fine. You know what? There are a couple of things. I want to tell you about this. There's a woman named Kara Buckley. Kara Buckley writes for the New York Times, and she recently did an article about Jordan Peele. Now, Jordan is getting his name in the papers right now because we're getting in that season where film critics are picking their best of the year, which leads into the Academy Awards. Wow. And he had such a great year with Get Out. And over the year, Keith and I were talking about this in a previous podcast. Like, over the summer, I didn't go out to see as many movies as I usually do because I was getting better stuff on Netflix.
Right.
But the few films that I did see, and also, and maybe because it's, you know, I'm well over 50, I said, man, every movie has a caped character. I don't, you know, that's fine, but like, is everybody flying through the air and wearing a cape? I want to see some real characters. So I loved Get Out, the movie The Big Sick. There was an indie film with Salma Hayek, Beatrice at Dinner, and the big budget war film Dunkirk. I like that.
Oh, but, okay.
But Get Out just made my jaw drop. Wait, man, this was so imaginative and so creative, and I hope Jordan Peele gets at least an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay.
Oh, that's so, right, because that is this year. Oh, I can, you know what I mean?
Right. Wow. Right. So Kara Buckley of the New York Times wrote, and the article is called, quote, "I'd never seen my fears as an African-American male on screen." And she quoted him, here's an excerpt. "Also, being biracial, he felt discouraged by the lack of people of color in the industry." And why I wanted to read that excerpt is, that is basically why Keith and I do this podcast, for real. Because we were growing up, where Keith grew up, and I grew up in L.A., not where Keith grew up, but we weren't seeing black people on TV doing the film reviews.
Not
we
in
weren't
Texas,
seeing
honey.
Black people on TV do review the Broadway plays or the off-Broadway plays or stage in general. And I bet you if we interviewed Jordan Peele, that he would know exactly what we mean, especially when we said, if you asked most white Americans to name two black film critics that they saw on national TV on a regular basis, they could only name the men on film two snaps up from In Living Color.
I mean, they were fierce.
But
that's, you're right, though. But, sad to say, you are absolutely correct.
You know, diversity, the arts demand diversity. That's how I feel about it. And the same should be held for the discussion of the arts. So because we're not a part of that discussion, especially in the arena of film critics on TV, you watch it year after year. It's a white guy telling you why you need to see Do the Right Thing, mm-hmm. The Color Purple, yep. The Help, The Butler, 12 Years a Slave, and Straight Outta Compton, which has made you know, because I grew up in South Central L.A. Now, David Edelstein, who was on the CBS Sunday Morning Show, mm-hmm. and he reviews films. I mean, God bless him. He's a good writer, and he could do a good review. And not that you have to be black to review a movie about black life, but do you think that David Edelstein ever had to wait for a bus in Compton? Like I did.
Not as of late.
So how come I can't get on TV and talk about how good Straight Outta Compton was?
Because they don't care. White people don't care, Bobby. You know about it. They don't care. That's a lie. They do care. You know what it is? I think it is because whoever it is that's decided that the voice of whatever should only be this particular way is kind of like, you know, whoever that is, like that mysterious, distant Harvey Weinstein or you know, some sadistic Louis B. Mayer kind of energy that's there, that's saying that this is the only way that this is going to work if the person is this way. And what's awful is that we have proven time and time again that also by not being this way, we are bringing something much more interesting to the table. And because of that, we're bringing interesting people with us to the table that enjoy
it's
having that kind of conversation or that kind of banter, that kind of, you know, I'm still thinking about that last episode as you as Imogene. I'm just saying, like, you know, if you're a classic film buff, no matter where you are on the spectrum, you know that shit is funny.
Thank you.
And if you think about the reference and think about who's saying it and who's using it and how it's being used, you totally get a different perspective of it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it means so much more. And so I'm glad that we get to do this, and I'm glad that we're doing it in spite of whatever popularity, because in the end, what we need to do is just continue to create and continue to keep talking, continue to still stay present, because eventually, you know, the pendulum is going to swing back.
And somebody will get it.
You know, I hope that I don't have to get like...
So I don't keep sitting in the back seat looking like Imogene in the moon.
Or begging to get on the wrecking ball like Miley Cyrus. Got to get on there naked and stuff. Trying to break down the walls.
Tough fear for real. When Jordan said I'd never seen any of my fears as an African-American male on screen... And one of the reasons for that was because we usually didn't make it to the second reel. Whenever, am I right? Whenever you saw a scary movie and there was a black person in it, you went, oh, we're going to be gone in the first half hour. We never made it to the last 10 minutes.
You know, the only black actor, black character that's ever really survived like a Jason horror movie that I can remember, it was, you remember the actor that I think played Dudley on Different Strokes?
Yes, I do.
And I believe I'm going to look it up now, but he was in one of those Friday the 13th movies.
And he made it to the end?
And he made it to the end, but this is one moment that I remember. So he's like running with the white girl. They're both being chased by the crazy guy. And no. I think she like falls down or something. And he just kept on running.
Woo!
To the point it was like he was in a little, I remember he was wearing like a red hoodie. And all you saw was the hoodie and the jeans. It just,
he kept on going.
And you just hear this when he ran by the camera.
He was probably thinking, okay, that's to make up for Sydney pulling Tony Curtis up in the Defiant Ones.
I laughed so hard. I was like, I remember watching that on a videotape and having to rewind it again because it was like, oh, look, he survived.
Oh, my God.
Because he did the right thing. He just kept running. Sorry, white girl. I got to leave you, girl. I'm sorry.
But even you know, when I interviewed Samuel L. Jackson, and you know, Samuel, do you remember seeing Samuel L. Jackson in Jurassic Park?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And as soon as I saw him, I went, "Uh-oh, dinosaur food!"
Yeah.
And the other one, Deep Blue Sea. Remember that one?
He died in that one too, didn't he?
Okay, Deep Blue Sea is like ghetto Jaws.
Didn't that? That's the one that had Queen Latifah in it too. No,
and LL Cool J. LL Cool J's in it.
Yeah,
and it's a bunch.
Unfortunately, it
was ghetto Jaws because that shark had a grill on its teeth. And ate Sam up.
Just tasty.
It tasty.
It's like
Jordan. Oh man, I would be so happy if he gets an Oscar nomination. And the way that he referenced, he was obvious. Now here's a guy like that. should be brought on as a guest host for Turner Classic Movies, mm-hmm. TCM, because he referenced classic films to that, which he said in interviews, The Stepford Wives, mm-hmm. Rosemary's Baby, mm-hmm. and there was a strong touch of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner,
mm-hmm.
and which brings me to some news for you folks. And Turner Classic Movies, TCM, in conjunction with Fathom Events, is holding big screen screenings of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner on December 10th and December 13th. So if you go to, you can log online to Fathom Events, you can go to a Cineplex and see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner again on a big screen. So this is the movie, and you know the plot. It's Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, legendary Hollywood couple. Tracy's last film. He died shortly before the movie was released. Katharine Hepburn won the Oscar for Best Actress, one of her four Oscars Best Actress. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Sidney Poitier is the accomplished doctor who falls in love with a white girl who's the daughter of the Spencer Tracy, Kate Hepburn couple in San Francisco. Now, if I just wanted to talk about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner a little bit right now, because I think through the years, people, because of their affection for the actors, especially Tracy and Hepburn, see the movie as kind of sentimental,
mm-hmm.
and don't really pay attention to the subtext of the movie, which I want to talk about right now. And Sidney Poitier's character, it was a surprise to his parents that he had fallen in love with a white girl. And if you listen, pardon me, to conversations before, you can tell that Dr. Prentice's wife, his first wife, Dr. John Prentice, Sidney Poitier, was black, and they had a baby son. The wife and the son were killed in an accident, and he's been a widower for about 10 years, maybe longer. And you get the impression that dealt with his grief by becoming an overachiever in his work. He wrote a couple of textbooks. He was accomplished, but that's how he handled the grief. Right. I'm just going to, just work.
Right.
And I think that when people see the movie now and Spencer Tracy is lovably crusty, and you think maybe, is he against interracial marriage? And I say, no, it's not that. But Matt, the Spencer Tracy character, is the owner of a newspaper. And he's been with this newspaper for years and years and years. And if you listen to the dialogue, it's mentioned that it's a liberal newspaper, and he has been the champion of some major social issues and social causes. So why is he so concerned that his daughter wants to marry a black man, right away, without thinking of it? Mm-hmm. I say it's because, as a reporter, as a journalist, he has seen and has had to cover the dark side of American behavior.
Exactly.
He obviously was there when President Kennedy got elected, and he knew that America had a long history of bigotry towards Catholics, and Kennedy won the election, and he was Catholic. He knows the civil rights movement, the killing of Medgar Evers, the March on Washington, the Birmingham church bombings, the murder of the four little girls,
mm-hmm.
and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, that these are things that Matt definitely had to put in his newspaper. And that is why he's concerned, because he doesn't want these two people who are dear in his life to be subjected to that kind of ignorant social attitude.
And the kind of hatred and ridiculousness.
Right. And also, keep in mind that when Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was in production, it was in production before the Loving versus Virginia decision. So when the movie was made, when they were making the movie, interracial marriage was still illegal in several American states, which is mentioned by the character who plays Sidney Poitier's father, who says, right. Don't you could be, you're committing a crime in some states. So that's how America was. And Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was one of the five nominees for Best Picture. Another nominee for Best Picture was In the Heat of the Night. So you had two movies starring Sidney Poitier that were nominees for Best Picture. In the Heat of the Night won the Oscar for Best Picture, but that year, the Oscar ceremony was postponed a couple of days, maybe longer. And it was postponed for the first and only time in Oscar history. Why? Because of the assassination and funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yep.
So when you get when you keep all of that history in mind, all of the and you see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, I think you'll find it's really got more gravity than we've come to realize over the years. Because people may have forgotten some of that history.
When you put it in that context, it really does make the film stand out in a different way. I love that.
And you know how I love TCM. TCM, it's, you know, I love you. It's time for you to get some black people on the air there.
Period.
Because at the screening, Tiffany Vasquez is going to be hosting. Love Tiffany. She's one of the three hosts. Uh-huh. They've got Ben Mankiewicz, good guy. Eddie Muller, good guy, never met him. And Tiffany Vasquez. And Tiffany is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So you will see her on the big screen doing the intro before the film is shown. And I think, you know, in a case like that, they should hook her up with somebody African-American to help her out with that. Just to, you know, give you some flavor of history at the time.
Well, at least if they do give you the history at the time, then it has it gives the flavor. Like, you know, it's sort of like it, you know, it has a different kind of bottom to it, if you know what I'm saying. Like it right. holds up better with a foundation like that. But
I thought of this early this year at the Turner Classic Films Festival in Hollywood. They celebrated the 50th anniversary of In the Heat of the Night, which was a red carpet event. You know, that's how they have the TCM Film Festival. And Tiffany was there and Ben Mankiewicz was there. Also, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of In the Heat of the Night and to attend the screening, Lee Grant, who was in the movie, Norman Jewison, the director, the producer was Quincy Jones was there. He did the score. And Sidney Poitier was there. And Ben Mankiewicz asked some really good questions about the social and racial significance that In the Heat of the Night still has in this age of Black Lives Matter. And I thought,
interesting.
You know, thank goodness. It would have been cool to have a black person for TCM on the red carpet at that event.
You know, they always could just go contract. They don't have to keep you there forever. You know what I'm saying?
Because,
you know, you just let it be. Just let it be and see. You know what I'm saying? Let it be and see. Because the thing is that they're so quick to stop before it even actually has a chance to open. But then there'll be opportunities more to come for other people as they figure it out. You know what I mean?
As somebody who has watched Turner Classic Movies and been a hardcore fan of that channel since 1999, I noticed that it just seems ironic that the less we saw of the late, great Robert Osborne, we almost saw less and less of an African-American presence because he was such a champion for black filmmakers and black artists and black films. He had Charles Burnett as a guest one time. Recently was awarded an honorary Oscar, and we'll see him the next time the Oscars are on. We'll probably see footage of him receiving the Oscar. He was a recipient along with Donald Sutherland. And Charles Burnett made Killer of Sheep, an indie movie. He made these beautiful independent films about the neighborhood I grew up in, about South Central L.A. So with Osborne, we saw, like I mentioned, Mr. Burnett. We saw Donald Bogle, who wrote a great book about Ethel Waters. And we also saw artists as guest programmers, like Whoopi Goldberg, Diane Carroll, Lou Gossett, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Spike Lee. And now we rarely see a black guest host or co-host on Turner Classic Movies, and I you know, I think it's time for them to pay attention to that, because we're going into a new year and it's the 21st century.
Yeah. And things are just, they got to change.
Yeah.
Boom.
Boom. And there you have it. So so keep that in mind. If you want to see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner on a Big Screen, hosted by Tiffany Vasquez of Turner Classic Movies, it's going to be on the big screen, a Fathom event. So, like, if you're on Twitter, just go to Fathom Events. That's F-A-T-H-O-M Events. And the dates are December 10th and December 13th. Okay, so there you have it. Perfect. Now, I want to ask you something.
Okay.
Did you see the Carol Burnett anniversary show?
It's on the DVR. I haven't had time to go back to see it. Oh, I knew you were going to ask me. I knew you were going to ask me. Damn it. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, then, okay, you had to, we will talk about that at a later time. But I wanted to tell you this Carol Burnett story, because, you know, we talked before about how brilliant she is. And the, well, wait till you see the anniversary special. And this goes back to some, I was working in Milwaukee, and this is the early 1980s. So in the history of the Oscars, it's been very rare for a woman to be on stage alone to announce the winner for Best Picture. It's usually a guy, and very few women have done it. Carol Burnett was one of the few women who went out alone, and she announced the Best Picture winner. And I believe it was Gandhi that year.
Wow.
So Neil Gabler, who's an author, G-A-B-L-E-R, good guy. I've read some of his books. He was in Milwaukee on a book tour. He was promoting a book, and the Oscars had just been on. And he kind of made a snarky comment about Carol Burnett. I was like, what was she doing there awarding Best Picture? Carol Burnett. And you just knew that the attitude was, she's just a comedian on a TV show. Okay. I felt, which, you know, wow. Of course I raised my hand. She had every right to be there, because in addition to doing the TV show, in which she was brilliant, she also made movies with some of our most renowned and respected directors. Carol Burnett was in two movies directed by Robert Altman, A Wedding and Health. All right. She was in a remake of The Front Page, directed by Billy Wilder.
Wow.
On TV, you know, we said she was so brilliant, Friendly Fire.
That's right.
And right. And she was in Annie, directed by John Huston. I loved her as Miss Hannigan in that movie version of Annie. And she did a movie that, this really made me realize the depth of her talent and creativity. She did a 1972 movie, a comedy drama, more drama than comedy, called Pete and Tilly.
Yes. It's,
and it was directed by Martin Ritt. Martin Ritt, who gave us Norma Rae, the film version of The Great White Hope, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, and Paris Blues, which we talked about before.
Right.
And one of my personal favorites, HUD. Yeah, you had to listen to an earlier podcast. So there's Carol Burnett. The action takes place in San Francisco, Pete and Tilly. And she is, you know, she does the opening voiceover. She's in her 30s, and, you know, she's what you would call a spinster, but she's not, like, pathetic. You know, she's got, like, this wry sense of humor. She knows what the deal is, and her friends are trying to hook her up with blind dates. And so she winds up going with on a date with Walter Matthau, who plays Pete, and he's just, like, constantly joking, but they have a long-time affair, and then she says, you know, the honeymoon's over. It's time to get married. And they get married, and they have a child, and there is an illness. Okay, that's all you need to know. And Carol Burnett, I paid to see that at a theater because I was still in school, and it came out, I think it was out over the summer, you know, when her show was on hiatus, and I went, oh, my God, because there are some heartbreaking moments in this movie. And she just nails it. She's just, she, it's, She's so good. And she's also funny. The movie got an Oscar nomination for Geraldine Page, one of the best girl fights I'd ever seen in a movie. Carol Burnett and Geraldine Page. It winds up going outside, then involves plastic trash cans and water hoses. It is, it's wonderful.
Wow. So that, fabulous.
And so if you can ever find this, what I came to realize after I saw Carol Burnett, and I was, you know, I was still a kid then, after I saw Carol Burnett in 1972 in Pete and Tilly, then I looked at her work on The Carol Burnett Show, and I went, okay, she has taken life, and she's playing one side of the coin. Because if you, you know, you look at her as Eunice and Mama, if you play the, if you took those characters and you put them in David Mamet's typewriter, mm-hmm. it would be an entirely different thing. You know?
Totally. So
if you could ever find it, if you want to see the fabulous dramatic acting of Carol Burnett, 1972, Pete and Tilly, and it was one of the first movies I ever saw in which there is an openly gay character who was neither the victim nor the psychotic killer.
Thank God.
Really? And it's, you know, I mean, at the beginning, he's a little bit bitchy, but he ultimately is one of those loyal friends who, when you're really down and out, he's there and offers to help. And it was played by René Auberjonois.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
The fabulous René Auberjonois.
A positive gay character. So there you have it. So, and I just...
Oddly, very sexually ambiguous to me when he was on Benson, but that's a whole other story.
Other story.
I love it. Well, we're going to have to run, man. Dang.
Yeah, so, yeah, Pete and Tilly, I love Carol Burnett. And since I mentioned Annie, and I loved her as Miss Hannigan in the movie, maybe John Huston wasn't the right director, but she got to work with him.
That's
Lord
right.
Lord knows he put out some Hollywood classics, like Treasure of Sierra Madre and The Maltese Falcon. You saw a production of Annie, and I wanted to know how you liked it.
I loved it. It was at the Paper Mill Playhouse in Millburn, New Jersey. I just got through recording my holiday choice things for people to do when they come to New York, and that is on the show because you can get to Millburn, New Jersey for less like 35 minutes by train and go see this fantastic production with Tony Award-winning Beth Level, two-time Tony Award nominee Christopher Siebert, and these fantastic kids that just, it was the most beautiful, fun, joyous, you know, Miss Hannigan played by Beth Level, honestly, I don't think was ever as genius on stage as, like, she is about as good as it's going to get, like, up to Dorothy Loudon level. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, my gosh.
She was that fabulous. I love her already, but she was amazing in that role. Amazing. And so highly recommended. I loved it, loved it, loved it. If you can come to New York or you can go to New Jersey, if you're already in the New York area, it is a train ride away and you get the most fantastic, I mean, truly the most fantastic experience.
It's worth the money.
And it's worth
the
money.
The price of the ticket.
And it's worth the price of the ticket. Absolutely. And it's a Tony Award winning.
It had through the years because the song Tomorrow is part of our Great American Songbook right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
And you know, it just, I was one of those people who in the original run thought, okay, I guess it's like, you know, a bunch of kids and it's based on a comic strip. And do I want to go, if I get to New York, do I want to see it? Well, Carol Channing was on tour in a revival of Hello, Dolly. Carol Channing was extremely good to me. Gave me two interviews. And I remember that after she played a week in Milwaukee at our big theater, and on her opening night, there was a press conference. And this really stuck out in my mind that she just didn't keep the spotlight on her. She turned it on other plays. She shared the spotlight. Carol Channing shared the spotlight. And she talked about Annie and the significance of this musical comedy. And what stood out is that she said, you know, you have to keep in mind, it's sort of like, you know, giving you historical backdrop, like I hope I did with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. She said, it's the Depression. Annie is an orphan. At any moment, she could be one of those nameless people who is lost to that grave situation called the Depression. And for her to have nothing, absolutely nothing, and still have hope in tomorrow, that is significant. And I went, oh, wow.
That's deep.
So I had an opportunity to go to New York, and I saw Annie, and I got it. When she sang Tomorrow, it was like you wanted to just stand up and cheer.
Yes. Yeah, well, let me tell you something. The cheering is going to go all over on this production if people go check this out. I'm telling you, it's amazing.
Really?
It's amazing, Bobby. Like, it should, if this were to be revived on Broadway in the current form, I wouldn't be mad. I would not be mad.
Wow.
But it's going to still lose to Once on This Island because that is the revival to look out for, honey. I'm telling you. Well, we got to run, Bobby. I'm off to go to the theater again.
Okay. Thank you for letting me talk about Get Out, and thank you for sharing that about Annie with us, Keith. Do you fantastic. Want to tell people about your podcast again?
They can find me, Keith Price's Curtain Call, on featured podcasts on BroadwayWorld.com, iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Broadway, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, and anywhere else you can find me.
And you can find me, Bobby Rivers TV, on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening to Mocha, Man of a Certain Hue and Age. We'll be back in your ears later.
Mocha.